interest in archaeology at Concordia Seminary is not simply one of historical interests or one of biblical backgrounds. It is of theological importance. The incarnation of God in the person of Jesus revealed a plan of salvation that honored his creation and became part of it for the sake of its redemption. Thus, the very stuff of human history, especially that holy history of God's own people, especially where God located his salvation in a specific time and place on earth, became not so much a holy land, but, as Hebrew idiom would put it, a place of his holiness, where he caused his name to dwell. Biblical archaeology, as a historical and scientific discipline, moves far beyond such theological assumptions. And Concordia Seminary recognizes with appreciation and a spirit of cooperation the work of the American Schools of Oriental Research, in which we have held institutional membership for decades. We are pleased to be able to have with us today Dr. Rudy Dorneman, President of the American Schools of Oriental Research, who, by the way, is also a fellow traveler on the Lutheran Road. But this moment is special in another related way. It is my pleasure to announce this morning officially the beginning and public announcement of the Concordia Archaeological Society. Anchored at this institution, the Concordia Archaeological Society will promote the work of archaeology throughout the Lutheran Church, especially Missouri Synod. It will seek to coordinate efforts and interests among both individuals and the academic institutions of our church. And I am very pleased to announce this morning that Dr. Lee Maxwell, who serves as our instructor in the area of archaeology, has agreed to serve as the first director of this society, and that he and seminarian Kevin Tiaden will participate in a dig this summer. Indeed, it is the dig sponsored by our guest today, Etel Karkur. As representatives of our archaeological society and with the financial support of this society as a part of Concordia Seminary. I'm very pleased to be able to make this announcement. This is a dream that some of us have had for years, and it is coming to fruition, and I encourage you, both individually and those with whom you will come into contact, to take an interest in the Concordia Archaeological Society in the future. It is an honor to have Dr. Dorneman here today, and it is an additional pleasure to ask Dr. Lee Maxwell, director of the Concordia Archaeological Society, to introduce him.
Thank you, Dr. Bartelt. I'll get more information out to you in the near future on the society and how you too can become a member. But in order that we don't delay our program any farther, I would like to introduce Dr. Dorneman, who is the director of the American School of Oriental Research. Is that right? Not president. You gave him a promotion without a vote. Just a little background on Dr. Dorneman. He did his graduate work at the University of Chicago at the Oriental Institute, which has a long history of interest and activity in Middle Eastern archaeology. His MA thesis was on temples in Syria, and his doctorate was on the archaeology of the Transjordan, the area east of the Jordan River, during the Bronze and Iron Ages. For those of you not familiar with that terminology, the Iron Age, of course, is the in Palestine is the age of the monarchy beginning under Saul and David and Solomon through the Babylonian destruction in 587. Dr. Dornemann is currently director of the American Schools of Oriental Research. Before that, he was curator of history at the Milwaukee Public Museum for 16 years. Before that, he was the director of the American Center of Oriental Research in Amman, Jordan, the first director from 1967. And before that, he served as an advisor to the Department of Antiquities in Jordan. His excavation experience is both broad and comprehensive, working at his first dig, which by coincidence happens to have been the dig that Concordia Seminary sponsored in the 1960s at Tel Tanakh in Palestine. From there, he moved on to work in Jordan, Egypt, and currently Syria, where he's worked for a long time. And presently, the excavation being conducted is in northwestern Syria. So without any further background, I will let Dr. Dornemann get on with the program.
Thank you for the kind introductions. I may talk a little fast. I think I have a few too many slides. But I'm glad to see the growing interest in archaeology again at the seminary. There certainly is a lot of room for studies of archaeology in relation to the Bible. And I hope I leave you with a little bit of a taste for a number of things in that respect as I go through the slides. Could I have the first slide and I'll start off right away. For many of us who have spent a good deal of time looking at the biblical texts and studying the Bible over the years, the places that the places where many of these events took place have held a fascination for us all over the years. Of course, we're all familiar with Jerusalem, Bethlehem, Hebron here, some of the biblical sites like Gibeah, not far from Jerusalem, famous site of Jericho, where Kathleen Kenyon and others have excavated over the years. And we've seen and heard stories about Jacob's Well, where Christ visited many years ago. This is a church that had been built there. And the many stories that have centered on the Sea of Galilee. And this is a view from ancient Gadara, Umm Qais, looking down on the southern end of the sea, looking up towards the north, towards Tiberias and Capernaum. And just looking across the Dead Sea, Sea of Galilee itself, just to feel the setting of where these biblical events happened. Of course, the Jordan River, by American standards, is not much of a river, but it holds a lot of fascination nonetheless. And the Jordan Valley, of course, is central to many of the biblical accounts. And just to experience the location, experience the difference of climate, dropping down in the valley to well below sea level at the Dead Sea itself, and in the foreground, the community of Qumran, and on the opposite side, Mount Nebo and the hills of Moab. And looking across from Mount Nebo in the direction of ancient Jericho again. And again, another view of from Mount Nebo looking down onto the Jordan Valley itself and the Dead Sea. Of course, the places that are mentioned in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, the question of where are they? Can we locate those places? Do we know where they are? And what are the traditions that lead up to the location of these places? Here you have the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, the place where Christ was buried, venerated there in Byzantine tradition. But is that really the place, or are some of the other locations outside of the ancient city of Christ's time? Where were the ancient walls? Where was the site of Golgotha? Where was the site of Christ's burial actually located? With every location, there are traditions. Some of the traditions, of course, are a question: how valid are they? What do they mean? another place in just on the outskirts of Jerusalem, outside of the old city. You have the Garden of Gethsemane, traditional spot in the church at the foot of the city of Jerusalem, and the venerated place where Christ meditated in the garden. And of course, having just passed the Easter season, or just barely out of it, the Holy Week celebrations of Christ's path from Pilate's judgment hall through the city of Jerusalem, venerated in the different the traditions of where Christ stopped along the way, and having wound his way through streets like these, probably in ancient days, to the location of Golgotha. Then stepping back in still earlier time periods, at one point, I guess this was actually when I was first there working on the Tanakh dig back in 63, we stopped at the site of Dothan, and here you see the Bedouin tents in the area around ancient Dothan, and one can easily imagine how Abraham would have stopped at this location. When I stopped to visit the site where excavations had been conducted, I was told that this was the actual street where Abraham once walked. Now, that could have been, I'm not sure if it was. And recently, having done much more work in Syria, I've sort of bounced back and forth between Jordan and Syria in the last 30 years, and recently have done some guiding of tours. And one of the places that, of course, in Damascus is a popular spot for Christians is the Church of St. Ananias, where Paul spent some time in the location there. Another place that's venerated is the so-called St. Paul's Window, where St. Paul was to have been let down in a basket from the city walls, and there's a church commemorating that. Also, going back to the Sea of Galilee, but if you look off in the distance, turning to your right from there over the Golan Heights, you can see barely a mountain off in the distance, and that's Mount Hermon. And unfortunately, my camera was lost for the first 10 days. My luggage didn't catch up with me in Damascus on this last trip. And it was the first time that I was able to see from the outskirts of Damascus Mount Hermon. And it was amazing to virtually look, and there's Mount Hermon standing right above you. And that brought home to me the account of Paul's conversion on the road to Damascus, and that the traditional place of that conversion is virtually on the foothills of Mount Hermon in that particular location. And that things like that sort of put a different spin, a different aspect on what has happened in these places. Also in working in the Muslim countries, it's surprising to see that many of the Christian traditions and many of the Old Testament traditions have been interwoven into the Muslim traditions as well. This is the famous Umayyad Mosque, built in the end of the 8th century, beginning of the, in the 8th century, basically, in Damascus. And part of that shrine, inside the main hall, there's a shrine commemorating John the Baptist, and is said to be a place where John the Baptist's head is preserved. Of course, John the Baptist got around a lot, and he's venerated in a lot of other places, and different remains are in different places, but at least here we have that in connection with this. The tour guides like to tell you that one of the interpretations of the name of Aleppo, the ancient or modern Halab, is connected with the name, the Islamic word Halib for milk, and really there's a tradition which goes that Abraham, passing through this area, stopped at Aleppo and milked his cow. And because of that milking, Aleppo got its name. And they're quite serious about some of these traditions. There's actually a mosque in the foreground there on the citadel today that is called the Mosque of Abraham for that reason. And, of course, we go back to the patriarchal stories just after Abraham, where Isaac and Jacob went up to Haran and the Haran area to take their wives from their relatives, and stopped at Ain el-Arus, the spring of the wedding. It's gotten a little commercialized, but this is still commemorated as the place where those events took place. So you have these traditions all over the place. You have the ancient cities of the Roman world. I've shown you some of them with Jerusalem and Hebron. This is a slide of downtown Amman, and when you go there, you can see the remains of the Roman ruins on the citadel area. Look down onto the area where the ancient street ran and where the theater complex is located. The remains of the famous city of Jerash, the colonnaded street that leads through that city, and with cathedrals and churches all over in the Byzantine period, but with most of the classical remains in the street dating to the 3rd century of the Roman period, 3rd century AD. And the famous Temple of Zeus, looking down over a portion of the at the beginning of the street there. Huge remains in many places. Again, the site of Gadara on the overlooking the Dead Sea, the site where Christ was supposed to have driven the evil spirits into the herd of swine, and it apparently disappeared over the hillside somewhere here. Many of those locations, it's interesting to see them, but then what does it all mean? You have more of the ancient cities like Palmyra out in the desert that are well preserved, that are fascinating to view. Site of Apamea that has received very little attention but is also a fascinating ruin. And if you go to the right places, you can still see remains of the ancient Roman road as it once was and dating to the time of Christ. And you could see many of the early people in the church having trodden some of these ancient paths. Also, the traditions of the church as the church developed after Constantine. This is a particular elaborate monument dedicated to St. Simeon Stylites, a monk who spent quite a bit of time perched on the top of a pillar. And you can see that monument in the middle of the church there. The church was built around it in the early 5th century AD. And that was the location where St. Simeon spent 42 years of his life preaching and healing people and developing a huge following that resulted in the development of this church in his memory many years later. Stepping back in time again to the area that I'm much more familiar with, I've gone through basically some of the more visible things that you can see and the things that come to light when people want to visit the Holy Land. There's always a question of what can you relate to, what can you see, and as you go back into earlier periods, it's much harder to see, it's much harder to visualize, but when you're dealing with the Christian period, when dealing with the Roman or the Byzantine remains, you have much more to see. You can visualize things better, and you can also see how these things fit into the context of the textual material, the written material that we know about the period. As you go back further, that becomes much more complicated. The whole situation becomes more complicated because our evidence is much more scattered. We have to pick and choose wherever there's evidence available to try to build a framework, to build a picture. One of our resources, of course, is ancient Egypt, where the tombs, the walls of tombs and on the walls of temples, you have illustrations of contacts with of Egypt, in this case with peoples from Syria and Palestine. And you have suppliants, apparently Asiatics, coming to Egypt, representing the contact with the what is later the Holy Land. There are very few instances of actual contact. The big problem with archaeology and the Bible is how do you connect events and traditions that are represented in the biblical text with anything else. We now have a lot of excavation that's gone on. We have great detail about different chronological traditions, different pottery traditions, different architectural traditions, but how do they relate directly to anything we're interested in as far as the biblical text? And for the most part, there's a lot of discussion about trying to pinpoint how you fit these in, but many of the arguments are still kind of weak, and we're still looking for something to tie it together tightly. One of the few places where there is a link, and this is a stele of the King Merneptah in the towards the end of the 13th century BC, the very end of the Late Bronze Age, and he mentions that Israel is destroyed, Israel is no more. One of the first places we have Israel actually mentioned in another text from outside. But this is extremely rare and few and far between. We know from the biblical text the presence of the Philistines. The Egyptians talk about them as well. The Egyptians had to drive them off incursions from the sea and by land. And archaeologists recently have spent a good deal of time on the excavation of many sites in the Holy Land where the Philistines once dwelled. The site of Ashkelon, of Dor, Ashdod, Tel Mikne, many others have received a lot of attention recently. And taking the very typical, I use this slide because it just typifies the very traditional Philistine so-called pottery of the beginning of the Iron Age, dating to about the 11th, 10th century BC. And we're starting to learn more about that complex and then can see how the biblical accounts relate to that, how we can understand them in the context of what has actually been found. One of the greatest steps forward, of course, as far as understanding the biblical text comes quite late in the story and before the Iron Age and the Bronze Age, but sort of caps the transition between BC and AD, and that are the famous finds from Qumran, and this is a shot from the settlement of Qumran looking up into the hills up above. There weren't too many caves found immediately up here, but off to the right of this slide, many of the caves, and here you see a slide just showing the location of many of the caves that have been investigated with the famous archives and the famous libraries from Qumran. And here you see, some of you may remember Jim Sauer. This was again back on this Concordia year back in 63. Jim was poking out of, I think it's cave 4 there. This is where one of the larger groups of scrolls were found at Qumran. And that, of course, the impact of the study of the scrolls, despite all the controversy that have gone around that in recent years, as far as lack of publication, slow publication. On the other hand, there's a tremendous amount of information that is now available on the early Jewish sects, traditions, religious traditions, libraries, variant traditions. There's a tremendous amount of information that has become available and now bears on the study of early Christianity and early Judaism of the end of the first last centuries BC and the first centuries AD. Now, farther afield again, but of equal importance in many respects as far as archaeological monuments are places like the Dura Europus. Here you see a gateway into the large city and the location of the famous synagogue. Not far from this is one of the earliest churches that has been preserved in archaeological excavation. But here you see the remains of a huge fortress on the Euphrates River Valley, looking down on the valley itself here. And you're in obviously a different land. Compare that to the Jordan River slide from before. It's a different ecological niche completely. But this is a very international area. I've mentioned the synagogue. I've mentioned the church. You also have a Mithraeum. You have temples of Baal, and you have tremendous reliefs, tremendous murals that have been preserved that represent the traditions of all of these faiths in a visual form that is very seldom found anywhere else. Of course, when you're talking about Roman cities, everybody loves to go to Petra. Unfortunately, now you have to pay very dearly if you go there because the tourist fees have been cranked up very high. But the famous treasury building at Petra, looking at the downtown area, the Colonnaded Street, the Qasr al-Bint, and the many tombs all over, Petra is receiving much more excavation and documentation as far as the building remains that before were completely enigmatic and completely study was concentrated on the monumental tombs that are preserved. But I can unfortunately go on at great length at all of these details and I have to move along. I do want to get to earlier things quickly, but of course at many of the sites there are tremendous numbers of churches with beautiful mosaics. This is a mosaic in the church that has been excavated at Mount Nebo, the memorial to Moses there. And of course, at Madhava, one of the famous maps is the map of the Holy Land there. And in the upper left-hand corner, you see the city of Jerusalem in a 5th, 6th century version of the geography of the land. Now, when you step back in time, I mentioned the rarity of documents. You have a few things that are scattered here and there in Palestine for the Iron Age, for the time of David and Solomon, and later than that. But it's very rare, and it's a very much of a problem to try to understand the archaeological materials without being able to put it in a greater context. On the other hand, many years ago, this famous Mesha inscription was found. In that inscription, you have Omri and Ahab mentioned as people that had controlled parts of Moab before the king Mesha, who wrote this inscription. And in very almost biblical-sounding text, he talks about how he destroyed the shrines of Yahweh, destroyed the Israelites, dedicated their people of different villages to the god Chemosh, and how Chemosh was victorious and Israel is no more in the land. So it's a completely different side. The language is the same, the vocabulary is the same as what we're familiar with in Kings and so on, but it comes from a different side of the story. And that is a tremendous thing when you look into that in detail and compare. It provides us with a lot of information that is unexpected. Moving up to the north in Syria, Syria holds a fascination for me. I've really concentrated there, and I've worked at the Citadel in Amman and in the Jordan Valley at Tel Nimrin, and have spent a little bit of time at Qumran and Samaria and other places around the Near East. But the area of Syria provides a rare opportunity for documentation. In the Iron Age, in the Bronze Age, which is extremely hard to come by in Palestine. And as a result, I think Reagan would call it the trickle-down theory, I guess. Some of this does trickle down to our understanding. As we learn more about what's happening in Syria, we can start extrapolating and filling some of the voids of what's happening further south. One of the most important sites that have been excavated since accidental finds of tablets is the site of Ugarit, and you see the gateway going up to the palace area, the entrance to the palace there, and a plan of part of the palace that was excavated with many different archives. And this provides a tremendous amount of information for us for the 13th and 14th century BC, for the end of the Bronze Age. The city was destroyed with the Aegean influx of the sea peoples, destroying the Hittite Empire and many of the lands and cities that were allied with the Hittites. And in that central archive there in Area D, you actually have a kiln where the last tablets were fired from this palace area. And in that kiln, you have tablets of one of the generals or one of the admirals sending information back saying the enemy is coming. They're giving their numbers, telling what's happening, and warning Ugarit that be careful. And then you have the destruction. The last sort of messages back from the field. But in the palace, you have rich materials as well, artistically. Here you can see the Canaanite influence, but very strongly influenced as well by Egypt with the Hathor figure on the right-hand side. The intermixture of a lot of international motifs is extremely common at Ugarit in a very international period at the end of the Late Bronze Age. Here you see the Aegean influence, things that you see in Minoan artwork are dead exact for what you see on this little plaque, although there are features that indicate it's done by a local hand. A face that in ivory with inlays that represent basically the Hittite style of art. And as well the records in the palace area. Treaties and letters, international letters from Egypt, Mesopotamia, the Hittite kings, treaties signed by the Hittite kings, and here you see the Hittite king's bulla stamped on one of the tablets written in this case in Akkadian cuneiform, and it represents in the center panel the Hittite hieroglyphic script of the Hittite king as well. The important thing at Ugarit is a variation in the Late Bronze Age is a local development of either a syllabic or developing in almost into a fully alphabetic script, taking the syllabic, taking the cuneiform signs, doing away with the hundreds of signs that one has to learn for the understanding of the Assyrian and Babylonian texts. Here they've abstracted to under 30 signs, basically. Basically an alphabetic text with a very limited rendition of the vowels, but a lot of the local texts are written in this system of writing, as well as the religious texts. And of course, Ugarit is tremendous in providing us with a background for a lot of our poetic material in the Old Testament and a lot of the certain narrative portions. Here you have the representation of the altar in the foreground for the complex of the Temple of Baal and the statuette that sort of simplifies that god. Next to that you have the Temple of Dagon, and of course all of the Ugaritic pantheon is represented. One of the main gods is the god Ael, that's probably represented in this little statue. But the temple area where you see D and B, B is the Temple of Baal, D is the Temple of Dagon. In between those, you see all the houses, the plans of houses that have been excavated there. And here you see the same thing just in a architectural plan. Those areas contained tremendous archives of religious texts. So the mythological texts of Baal, the mythology of ancient Canaanite religion, but from the point of view of Ugarit, are well represented at this site and provide a tremendous impact. But there's still an awful lot to be done on these texts. Basically, only the surface has been scratched as far as how they relate to anything. At Ugarit, the concentration has been on the late Bronze Age and the remains that I've just shown you, but there have been some soundings which indicate that Ugarit has been around for a long time. And at the bottom of this deep trench, you have Neolithic settlement of the very earliest periods of the Neolithic, pre-pottery Neolithic in Syria. So it is a site that is important and exists for a long time. One of the places that is mentioned as the seat of the god, temples for the gods Baal and Ael in Ugarit are the is the site of Safon, as being the place where that where those temples are located, and is sort of the sacred mountain. This is the a picture from the distance of that sacred mountain from the site of Ras al-Basit, one of the northernmost sites along the Syrian coast before you get into the area of Turkey nowadays. But you can see how such a high mountain can become a sort of mysterious center for the religious and cultic practices of that day. Can I get the next slide, Trey, please? And one of the other sites that has yielded a huge amount of written material is the site of Mari. And this is, I showed you the slides of Dura Europus on the Euphrates. Mari is a little farther south, very close to the Iraqi border. And you see on the right a little high point there, and off on the left you see a little rise just in the middle of those telephone poles. This tell is a huge tell, but it's a very shallow tell. From the distance you can't see it's there. But it depends on the agricultural resources of the whole area immediately around it, and is extremely rich as a bridge between the Mesopotamian centers of Babylon, Babylonia, and Sumeria in the south, and Assyria off to the northeast of there. Here you see people walking through the remains of some of the palaces that have been excavated at Mari. Oops, I did put that one in upside down. The photograph of the famous palace mural at in the throne room area of the palace of the second millennium, so-called Zimri-Lim Palace, the palace that was destroyed by Hammurabi of Babylon. And some of the famous artwork of that time period decorates the Syrian currency even today. And then cutting down beneath the palaces, there are many series of shrines and other earlier palace areas dating back into the third millennium BC. And you have religious traditions with temples to many of the Mesopotamian gods, as well as many of the Syrian gods being venerated. And you know, I could give several lectures just on the temples without any problem. I can't go into great detail on that, but in those temple complexes, you have preserved the offerings dedicated to the gods by the local rulers for the most part and important people in the city, and dedications in a cuneiform on their shoulders saying who it is and who they have dedicated the statue to. And here you have the statue, which represents a very flowering of the Sumerian style of sculpture very late in the early dynastic period. Talking about Mesopotamia, just a few slides quickly to highlight the emphasis of the land of mud brick and mud for building material, where there are very few stones, that stone has to be brought in, wood has to be brought in, any sizable wood. And of course, this is a text, I think, of the creation epic from Mesopotamia. But you see the use of the cuneiform writing that is well developed, and this is what has been found then at Mari in a local style, and at Ugarit, and throughout Syria, and as you'll see in a moment, there's also at Tel Mardikh. And that famous site that has been excavated in the last couple of decades, a site that we didn't know about, where it was located before. We knew of Ebla in Mesopotamian texts, but we didn't know where it was. It was located anywhere within about a 1,000-mile radius of Syria somewhere. And even when the first inscriptions were found, scholars were still saying, no, that's not the place. It's got to be somewhere else. But then with the excavations at Tel Mardikh here, first starting on the citadel area and then stretching over many, many areas of the site, many temples have been excavated, several palace complexes have been excavated, and the area there where you see the gray is roofing over an area where the early archives that have given Ebla its basic fame, archives basically of the 23rd, 24th century BC, of a series of rulers from this city. And that city was destroyed by rulers apparently of the Akkad Empire moving from Mesopotamia into Syria in one very specific period of time. But the tremendous documentation that is available from this site is still receiving a lot of attention, but is only barely getting into the literature as far as general information is concerned that comes down to the general public. And unfortunately, in the early stages, there was so much enthusiasm by people that were trying to make a big name for themselves in connection with these finds, and there were claims of Sodom and Gomorrah being mentioned in these texts and several other biblical connections. None of those have panned out. The archive has basically proved to be much more parochial in nature. There are some international contacts, but much of the documentation is very much the Aleppo region, the region immediately around Tel Mardikh, that is being documented. The finds are invaluable, but have to be understood within their context and then move out from there, and there's an awful lot to be done to understand them in their context still. One other thing I want to mention is the excavations. Many things have gone on recently as part of salvage archaeology. You see Tel Hadidi located there, a place that I worked at in the 70s for the Milwaukee Public Museum. I also worked at Marabit Village down farther south at Selagahia on the left-hand side. Many of these sites have yielded tremendous amounts of information that have added completely new pages to ancient history. These are some temples that were excavated at the site of Meskene, and I have with me a couple illustrations of our biblical archaeologist that ASOR publishes, and there's an issue devoted to this site, the texts that were found at Amar, and in sort of balance to Ugarit, it provides us with something contemporary with Ugarit, but a whole new ball game as far as a lot of the information that is provided. And near these temples, a lot of religious materials again were found. A lot of calendars, religious rituals are illustrated. There are things, the practices that highlight the use of elders and people similar to basically the judges as a very important part of the structure of the ancient city. Now, what does that mean? We're just starting to get an idea of what that is, but it provides us with a lot of traditions that have mirrors in a lot of the things that we have in our Old Testament text of the judges and early monarchy in Israel, and provide us with links that many people were saying, oh, well, this must have been something that was developed by Israelites that were stationed in the exile and came up with, you know, reworked the biblical text at that point. Well, here we have things that go back to the 14th and 13th century BC, which represent traditions that clearly were in place for a much longer period of time and demand that we really look at a lot of these things in much greater detail. Looking down from a high point at Jebel Aruda here on the area that is flooded in the lake, you see a series of buildings which apparently are buildings of some of the people supporting religious structures on the site. Off on the left-hand side of the site, there are two temples that were excavated in very typical Mesopotamian style of architecture. I can't go on in detail, obviously. Across the lake on the other side is the site of Tel Hadidi, where I excavated. And one of the things there, we did find only a very small archive, private archive, of tablets in a building, which we call, ingeniously enough, our tablet building. But it is a small archive, and but it does give us the name of the site. Many of the sites that we excavate, we don't have any idea how to identify them, how to tie them down with ancient names. In this case, the name of Azu is connected with this site on several of the tablets. And in similar buildings across the river at a site the Germans have excavated, similar archives have been found, and they have tied down the name of their site as a Kalte, but also possibly the site of Ura. And there's been a lot of discussion, of course, as to where did Abraham come from? Was it Ur of the Chaldees, or was there another Ur around? Well, here's another Ur on the Euphrates, and apparently both Azu and Ura are mentioned in texts of the New Kingdom, at the very beginning of the New Kingdom, when Egyptian pharaohs came up to the Euphrates and list the names of cities that they conquered along the Euphrates, and these two cities are mentioned in those lists. So these are the types of information that just bits and pieces by accident are starting to fall into place. And here's one of the tablets that were found in the destruction of this tablet building, where the complete inventory of the building was basically preserved intact. From an earlier levels, we have a little plaque which represents an art style that is identical with what that upside down picture of the investiture scene from Mari is, the same type of dress, the same type of headgear. And this is a ceremonial scene, apparently people drinking beer through a straw in front of the symbol of the sun god, and apparently finalizing some sort of a covenant between them. In the still earlier levels, in the early Bronze Age, contemporary with the tablets at Ebla, we have elaborate tombs that have been excavated, well-constructed tombs that are surprisingly well-constructed for this early period. We just didn't know that that technology existed at that point. Unfortunately, most of these tombs have been robbed out, and it's been a very meticulous process of restoring those by putting everything back together that the tomb robbers discarded. And we witnessed, of course, the destruction of the village we had to live in at Hadidi, and the moving of some of the populations off to another area of the country, and some of them moving to higher ground and reestablishing the village of Hadidi at another location. This type of salvage archaeology has taken place in many different locations in Syria. The most recent projects are farther north on the Euphrates and in the Habur area, where Mike Fuller from St. Louis here and others have been concentrating on trying to salvage as much as they can from sites in that area. Then I want to close basically with getting to the site that we're working on now and sort of doing a reverse on the Hadidi, where we found out what the name of that ancient site was by accident, by hitting the right location and a small archive that provided the name. Here we have a site. If you look in the center of the picture, there's a little mound there. That's the site of Tel Karkur. Off to the left is the village. This is taken just off the road that goes from Latakia on the coast across the Jebel Ansariya mountain down to Jisr-Zuhur, and then across the Orontes Valley over to Aleppo. And farther south from the site of Karkur. In antiquity, there was a very marshy area that ran down to the site of Tel Esharna, very far south in the Orontes Valley, and provided now a very rich soil for cultivation in this area. Tel Karkur is equated with a site that's mentioned in Assyrian texts as a battle fought by a coalition of rulers, including Irhuleni of Hamath, Hadadezer of Damascus, and Ahab of Israel. And this coalition repulsed the Egyptians apparently for many years, but the Assyrian ruler, Shalmaneser III, mentions that he destroyed Karkur over and over again. Now, is this the site we're dealing with, or is there another site in the vicinity that's Karkur? How do we tie it down? How do we prove that this is really the site that we're looking for? So far, we have not found the written evidence that we'll need to make a concrete fix. But on the other hand, we've run into contemporary Iron Age materials with the time of Shalmaneser as far as pottery and other evidence that gives us a good indication that probably we're on the right site. But we have to keep at it to try to prove that that is really the case. Early excavation started in 1983 and 84 and then picked up again in 1993. We have now quite a portion of a gateway area that's been excavated. In the foreground, you see a stairway that comes up to the gateway, and then there's another stairway higher up, which is through the gateway, part of the gateway chamber, into the city itself. Up on top of that, you have a tower of much later date of the Ayyubid period. And just to give you a taste of how our work progresses there, the supervision, the notes, and photography, and architecture are drawn by people brought over, like Lee Maxwell and Kevin, I think, will try their hand at helping us document this summer. But this is the workers, that the type of workers they'll work with them. Actually, we won't be using women again, but we did have, in the first season, we did use women as well as men. In the trying to reestablish the sections of the earlier excavation, we ended up going back a little bit further to get clean sections to see how the stratigraphy ran. In the process, we ran into store jars still in place on the corner of the gateway chamber and found quite a few iron spear points that were in the destruction level there as well. In the room nearby, we found a small seal of the Iron Age with a little chariot scene and another animal of some sort. It's a very schematic thing. At the end of last season, we did have somebody come with a kite and take a photograph of our area of excavation. And you can see the stairway that I showed you at the bottom here. The remains of the city gateway is here, stairway going through. The rest of that chamber represented here. And then there's a sort of portico on that. And then inside here, we have remains of all sorts of buildings. And we have a street, a paved stone street, that moves out from the gateway into the city itself. And here you see on the other side of that Ayyubid tower, that street coming across. But then down below, we have the remains of a very large building, hopefully, and apparently still of the Iron Age. And hopefully in further exploration around that building, we'll be able to find a little more tight documentation for the site. But this large building is here. There's a doorway here. The rest of the building is covered up that way. We may have several rooms connected with it. We don't know what the foundations are over here yet. We need to pull this out and connect this together. But you see the street here from the gateway running across and should continue on quite a distance into the site itself. Just another view of that doorway area for that large building. And another view of the stairway, and then a trench that we started trying to run down the side to get a, actually the excavations in 83 and 84 indicated that there should be a Middle Bronze Age wall in this area. As we dug it, we found the Iron Age stairway instead. They were going by pottery that was on the surface, and then it wasn't associated clearly. We hope that we, going down the hill from here, we'd be able to run into some of the early occupation. So far, we haven't gotten out of the Iron Age, and we're still into, we may have reached the Iron Age in one foundation, but much of this is still Islamic material is quite late. So we have quite a ways to go. At the end of the season, we threw plastic over the top of things to try to keep it from washing away in the winter rains. And during the season last year, we had to deal with an irrigation canal that was being put in. You can see this line coming across there with some equipment on it, taking water that is being collected behind a dam, not in the hillsides off to our left there, and then bringing water down into the fields. But in the process, they were still running across part of the ancient site. So that in the trench, and here you see Lee watching over some of the work that they were doing, we did find the remains of an Islamic period kiln, going with some of the materials that we were finding at the foot of our trench on the tell itself. But this whole site in the pottery from the trench, obviously there's occupation of the Islamic period, Iron Age, Middle Bronze, Early Bronze, and we even had Neolithic pottery in this area. So the tell was not concentrated only to the high part of the site, but spread out quite a ways, and our concentration in the next couple of years is actually going to be, since everywhere we've gone, we've run into the Iron Age, we need to concentrate on tying down the site as far as the identification with Karkar of the Assyrian period, and trying to come to grips with understanding the time of that site, the site of that period. Other places on the site, on the top of the tell, one of the highest points, very close beneath the surface, we have a good Iron Age sequence. There's a whole series of Iron Age buildings and rebuildings here. Looking down from there onto the lower tell, you see the area of excavation down there. And there again, we have Iron Age occupation that we've come into to indicate that the Iron Age city was quite extensive in the 9th and 8th century. And again, I've mentioned the Shalmaneser III. Here you see the lines of indicating his different campaigns. And the highest one ends up after Aleppo at Karkur, where the king fought with that coalition starting in 853 BC and continuing on for quite a while after that. And we have records as late as Sargon II in the 7th century, or at the end of the 8th century, still talking about battles at Karkur with the Assyrian rulers. And just to highlight the things the Assyrians did, again, this is from the site of Tilbarsib, where a lot of the Assyrian materials are well documented in color. The stele, which one of them mentions, the Omri and Jehu of Israel. One of the others mentions Ahab and Omri in connection with the Battle of Karkur. And the place that controlled Karkur is the site of Hama, and here you see a plan where Danish excavations have been undertaken many years ago. And you see the type of Iron Age in dark there, excavation of major buildings around a gateway area on the right-hand side. That's the kind of complex that I expect we should be getting into on the Acropolis, just inside the gateway at Karkur, but it'll take quite a bit of work to really get at that. This is a period when we do have inscriptions, a site up on the north of Syria, Tel Fakhariya, not far from the ancient Tel Halaf, the land of Gozan, has a cuneiform inscription of the ruler on one side, and on the back side has a bilingual translation in Aramaic on the other side. Again, a tremendous amount of information and only barely studied at this point. I won't go in great detail on the map. You can see just the location of Karkur is located in this area here. This is this Bob area, marshy area. And excavations that have been done by the Orient Institute and the British Museum in the Amuk area here. Ancient Antioch is situated here, not far away from us. And this is Hama and Aleppo as the modern cities that are close by. The Iron Age, I mentioned, we have things to basically give us a fix time-wise. We have to rely on things like the Iron Age pottery, this red slip pottery, which is very typical of the time period, and to build the chronology so archaeologists can tie in with the material that we have. Some of the typical forms, some of the painted materials, imported things from Cyprus that help give a little more precise fix on dates. And Lee likes to see the Islamic material, which we have to deal with to get down to the Iron Age, and a very heavy Hellenistic occupation on the site, fortunately not with too much architecture preserved so far. Fortunate for me, but for the people interested in the Hellenistic period, of course, they want to see more of it. We do have a good representation of the Middle Bronze Age, Early Bronze Age, like the Ebla, and also going back to pottery of the Neolithic period. Fuchsia is here, and material of the end of the beginning of the Early Bronze Age and the end of the Chalcolithic period. So it has a very broad range of occupation on the site, but so far we have only touched the surface on it. Just a few slides finishing up to give you an idea of what it's like if you come join us. This is having the second breakfast about 9 o'clock. We start when the sun comes up, somewhere 5:30 or so, and then quit when it gets too hot, about 12:30, 1 o'clock. This is our crew from last season in the courtyard of the church complex we were using as our home base. This is our zoologist, of course. Archaeologists have to gather every shred of evidence they can find. We need to keep every bone we have. We do regular sampling of the soil for flotation to get the botanical remains out of it. Any sample that can yield information for analysis, we of course take that. And all the documentation then in as tight stratigraphy, the exact location of the material. We started very slowly with a small group, but it's something we need to build, and hopefully with continued involvement from Concordia, we can build a consortium of schools that can continue this excavation for a period of time and put it on the map like Ebla, Mari, and Amar. It has the potential, it's just a matter of sticking with it. This is the church that we used in our first seasons as our home base. And with that, I close. Unfortunately, the sunset, not a sunrise, not a sunset. But thank you very much.